Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin. With guest co-host,
Kale.
You guys are so, your glass is half empty as opposed to half full. I am sorry for you. I weep for you.
Really?
I just wiped away a tear, but you couldn't see it because this is an audio-only show.
Hey everybody, this is episode 161. This is your host Mad Jin with my fellow co-hosts Daniel Quick.
Happiness is maintenance of corruption.
Makalua?
Oh, you had to mention corruption. Civ 3,
The B&D?
I am the Spear Man.
And our guest co-host, Kale.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Otherwise known as Derek Paxton.
Also known as Merg.
Also known as that dude what has something to do with Fall from Heaven.
Also known as that dude who happens to be the lead designer on Fallen Enchantress.
Also that dude that was last on the show like more than 4 years ago.
Seriously.
I was just thinking, that was my first podcast I'd ever been on because I remember being so nervous before that. I prepared for it and I wrote down things that I wanted to make sure I mentioned and I really thought about it a lot before the podcast. Nowadays, I'm just like, I didn't prepare for this one at all. I just, what time you want me on? I'll be there.
It's like, yeah, man, I'm just going to show up in your podcast, talk about stuff.
Yeah.
That's what we do, so.
I'm not.
Gods and Kings won the 2012 Golden Joystick Awards for Best Strategy Game. The Ultimate Game of the Year went to Skyrim. Gee, I wonder why.
Because it was awesome.
Best role-playing game. But there were over 4 million votes that were cast for the 2012 event, which more than doubled the Guinness World Record set last year. So apparently this is also Guinness World Record. I'm not certain if that really raises its profile or falls under who gives a crap. But in any event,
it doesn't make any sense.
How did it become a world record, because, I mean, that's only 4 million votes. Big thrill. There's other places that have way more than that.
Maybe it the most votes for a gaming
board?
Voting, yeah, something or other.
That's a really pathetic award.
Record for you gaming losers.
Yeah.
You don't even use a joystick to play this game.
Jeez. Why would you use a golden one? It'd just melt eventually.
How can you have a vote for the 2012 Good. Game of the year when 2012 is still going on?
Because everything after That's this true. Goes on to the 2013.
Oh, okay.
Well, because wasn't Skyrim released last year?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, it was 2011.
This time.
Just because it wasn't out before the awards last year and missed it probably by a couple of weeks.
So for all of you haters, Gods and Kings won again.
Wait, what did they win the first time?
I don't know.
They didn't have much competition here by the looks.
So about that Forbidden Enchantress.
Fallen Enchantress that you can get at www.fallenenchantress.com for all the info.
I know, for some reason I said Forbidden, but that might have been a different topic altogether.
That's another game entirely. Yeah.
Entirely different game.
I like Forbidden Enchantress. That just sounds like a game that you would want your children to play.
Sounds like a game that you don't want to show up on your Visa card bill at the end of the...
So, on the topic of falling, there is a fall patch issues follow-up started by DR Keen, also known as Dr. Keen. Both 2K Forums and Sifnatics linked it, obviously. And it reads, sorry for the lack of update, guys. I can say today that Firaxis is working on a follow-up patch to address some compatibility problems from the fall patch. And there is a list of things they are working on.
Seriously, if you're using Intel Express chipsets to run a game that needs graphics, stop it. Get a new computer.
I enjoy how it put automatic annexing is the last item in the...
It's the only real balance issue, but real...
Yeah, it might be a slight problem.
But at least the AI is annexing cities again.
It is great to see that Firaxis is supporting their game. That fall patch was huge. So much stuff that they did there. And nice to see they're continuing to work on it and listen to community feedback and do the right thing.
Thank you.
Break the Beliefs. It's a really cool post that Casper GM put up where he went through the different belief systems in Civ 5 and got them out to the community, and then people voted on what they liked, which they thought were overpowered, underpowered, and he aggregated that data and suggest and linked them and showed, you know, these are the ones that the community seems to feel are really good and may be too powerful. These are the ones the community feels really weak and may be worth, you know, sprucing up a little bit.
Given that there were anywhere from 12 to 16 votes to come up with these aggregate numbers, I'm not sure how large of a sample of a community that represents, but it's there. It's there, and he discloses that.
Yeah, no, it's good. I mean, if you're going to do a survey showing how many people you surveyed, is a good thing. But I wouldn't take it on faith that any of these would be nerfed or boosted just because of this.
Wait a minute. Did you just say we shouldn't take this on faith?
Yeah.
Nice. I approve. That was like a stealth pun. Until I pointed it out and then I negated the stealthness, but whatever.
Yeah, stop negating my stealth. Fertility rights. Yeah, it's a good pantheon. It's not going to get nerfed. How do you nerf 10%? Below 10%?
Yeah.
If you go below 10%, then it's worthless.
Yes.
It's worthless. And this is probably one of the problems with these sort of rating things. And I did stuff on my Beyond the Monument show with Dan, where we went through a lot of these. The purely generic ones, like fertility rights, that you can always use, yeah, they're good, but like they've got Dance of the Aurora as needing a boost. And frankly, Dance of the Aurora is way better than fertility rights if you're in the middle of a tundra. By a huge margin.
Tends to happen in a lot of our games.
Yeah. The sheer amount of faith you can get out of it, just like the desert faith, is way better than fertility rights if you're there. So, you always got to take it with a grain of salt when you see some of these things. I mean, religious settlements, yeah, I could see that being right down on the bottom. 15% faster border growth, who cares?
Yeah.
It would be way lower than Densely Aurora, but it's probably the one pantheon belief that could get deleted and no one would notice.
And when we've discussed beliefs before, both on Polycast as well as Beyond the Monument, there are those that are more generic, that are kind of a catch-all in the sense that, well, you can use this to varying effectiveness most of the time, regardless of your start, regardless of what terrain you have around you, either for your initial city or maybe you're a second or a third city. So that way, you know, that consideration applying to whether or not you think you're going to be going tall or wide or what have you. But it's that situational that makes you stop and think, okay, particularly when it's a pantheon, do I want something that might pay off a little later in the future, you know, mid to late game, or do I want something that's going to accelerate me right here and right now? And if you're thinking about going to get a pantheon, and if your goal then is to get a religion, then you are better off looking at your situation, finding something that's going to give you that boost, either directly because it's going to be giving you faith, or it's going to be giving you some other boost to happiness or culture that then allows you to say, okay, it's easier for me now to expand and then increase my faith even more, buy more cities, get more shrines, get more wonders or whatever. It's not so much a good and bad or best and worst. But I think a lot of people here, when they're choosing these, they're thinking more about the, this isn't going to apply necessarily to 9 out of my 10 games, so therefore it needs a boost.
Yeah.
I do love so much, though, that Firaxis did include both of those sides there. So you can have the general strategy kind of, well, this is what I want to do in this game, and those options are there as well. But it's not enough, or it's not only those. So you always feel like, well, this is always the one I pick. I always pick this one because there are the situational ones there where you know, the forest or terrain or particular strategies that you have going on because particular things are happening in one game that pull you off of that normal road that you walk and have you going down those strange paths. But it's not just the situational ones, too, so you don't feel like, well, there's no choice here. If I'm in the tundra, I pick the tundra one. If I'm starting in a desert, I pick the desert one. So, you know, there's balance there of here's the more global ones, and then here's the little situational ones, and it makes me think about it every time I go through that process, and that's the goal of a strategy game to me. So yeah. I love the way they put this in.
Yeah, I mean, like, Dance of the Aurora, great. I mean, if you're in a tundra and you want lots of faith, Dance of the Aurora. But if you're in a tundra and you need food, Goddess of the Hunt. Extra food from hunting camps, which furs and deer and stuff like that is always in the tundra. Right there, there's two. Plus there's just the generic ones that you can bump up. There's only a few that are not great. God of Craftsmen, plus one production in cities with population of three. That's okay for an early game start. I mean, it's okay, but it doesn't rate higher than some of the other ones. Just on pure power. Like, if you take it from a, what will this give me across the length of the game, some are definitely better than the others. One of the other pantheons that hit the top, of course, was Messenger of the Gods. So they have two extra science in cities with the trade route. The problem with that is, it is really good when you ICS. You go for the infinite sprawl, two extra science per city with trade routes, and you pack them all in, and you have a good, you know, 20, 30, whatever cities. Yeah, you can get some science. But from what I've seen, the fastest way to win, and the more consistent way to win tech victory, is through Tall. So 4 to 5 cities at most. Going tall. So that two science in cities with the trade route doesn't really get you very far. So again, it's playstyle, and there's quite a few playstyle dependent ones in there. Hmm. So it's a nice balance, except for a couple obvious ones like religious settlements. There's just no reason for that one. I mean, it's nice. You can stack the tradition opener and religious settlements and the Angkor Wat, but there's still a 5 hex limit. Range. So eventually you're going to hit that, and then that won't be doing you anything. And actually, I was looking at the top ones of each of these, and if you look at them, there's a lot of ICS stuff in here. You go Messenger of the Gods for the Pantheon, toss in either Ceremonial Burial for the extra happiness per city, following the religion, or Tithe, the extra gold, if you need it. And then you go to the top Follower Belief. That's Pagoda. So you can buy Pagodas for 2 faith, 2 culture, and 2 happiness. And then you toss that off, finish that off with the Enhancer. There's another potential follower, but you finish it off with the Enhancers. The top two are the 2 core religion spread mechanic ones. So religious texts and itinerant preachers. So basically, of the 12 to 16 people who voted, I think a lot of them were playing super wide. So it might be a little skewed. It might not be enough tall players. Voting.
They're not all equal. That's a good thing. That's towards the choice that Magin and Derek have been talking about, and we've all been talking about, and not just on this episode either. As Magin also pointed out, that most of those that are listed as needing a nerf, having to do with concerns with regards to ICS or infinite city sprawl, that might be a segue in and of itself, because I think we're going to be talking about that some more.
Was that a segue? What? Yeah. Oh, God.
That's not a segue. This is a segue.
These are the smoothest transitions I've ever seen.
Wait a minute. What are you saying? I'll show you a segue? Is that what you're saying?
Corruption versus city maintenance versus global happiness. Corruption. Stupid. I don't think I'm going to try this username, but he said, once I felt corruption was a bad system and that scrapping it would unleash the player just for him to be able to rule full-capacity cities. Then city maintenance came, and he hated the system because it was too obscure, and came from global happiness. I'm hating the system since Prince difficulty. I always feel I have not enough. I can find absolutely no synergy with my other occupations, aka conquering or expanding. I have to wait long, long times for my happiness is up again.
Corruption lowers the total trade goods intake in cities on the fringes and the frontiers when you have an empire that sprawls over a great area. In Civilization 1, depending upon your type of government and the city's distance from your palace, some trade may be lost. As corruption, the farther your city containing your palace, your capital, the more corruption was lost by trade. In Civilization 2, it was very similar, where resource output can be lost through corruption. In many games, the amount of corruption was heavily dependent on a city's distance from the civilization's capital, as well as the overall number of cities controlled by the civilization. And the amount of corruption also depends on the presence of certain improvements that reduce corruption, such as courthouses, which also appeared in Civilization 1, and also the type of government 2. In Civilization 3, the Conquests expansion, which was the second expansion for Civ 3, and then Civilization 3 Complete, which included Conquest, the first expansion, Play the World, and Vanilla Civ 3, it changed it a little bit over what corruption was initially in Civ 3, so I'm going to summarize on that point, where the total corruption in each city was equal to the sum of 2 independent components, distance corruption and rank corruption. If you had a non-communal government type, say, despotism, distance corruption depends on the distance from each city from its closest palace, which is either the palace or the forbidden palace, which counteracted distance but not rank corruption. Civilization III introduced that. Rank corruption in a city depends on how many other cities are closer than that city to the palace. So you kind of saw that in Civilization 2, but then you had a specific separate name for that and part of the formula. if you had a communal type government in Civ 3, then distance corruption did not actually depend on distance because each city was considered to be the same distance from the palace. You had choosing a commercial civilization to reduce corruption in your cities, kind of saw that with an indirect way, say in Civilization 4 with the financial trait that would help you with your economy while you were expanding, for example, peacefully or not so peacefully. Still building appropriate city improvements, which of course you see in Civilization 4 and Civilization 5. Now, of course, in Civilization 5, the courthouses get to when you're annexing a city. And of course, Wonders of the World. Connecting your cities to your trade network for your empire also reduced corruption, and Civilization 3, I even had to stop and think about this for a moment, there were specialists. You could assign citizens to be policemen, where one policeman meant that one corrupted commerce and one wasted shield became uncorrupted. And then in Civilization 4, the manual goes into detail about why they moved from corruption to city maintenance. And I'm going to summarize here. With introducing maintenance over corruption. Quote, "We were both right and wrong. The change did put an end to building as many cities into as tight a space as possible, but it was also the number one complaint about the game. Gamers simply didn't like having their production taken away from them. There was nothing fun about founding a city and then finding out it could only ever produce one shield a turn. A revamped maintenance system could provide a subtle resistance against building more cities being the only, quote-unquote, best choice." And then for Civilization 5, global happiness, with the only restriction being the buildings that purely provided happy would only reduce unhappiness by the amount of citizens in the city and couldn't do more than that. And then local happiness was the happiness generated from buildings, not wonders, and is used to negate population unhappiness in a specific city.
One other detail, though, because again, you have, if you want to take it into the consideration of what the limiters are, more cities equals more buildings equals more building maintenance in Civ 5. So you do actually pay more for more cities, gold-wise. And that can ruin your economy, because once you go negative in your gold per turn and you've run out of gold, then you lose science until you go bankrupt.
So he wants to know what the system is that everybody else prefers. And right now, city maintenance is winning, but then there's only about 13 votes in this poll so far.
Now there's 14.
Oh, now there's 14. Yeah, we don't want corruption back. Do we all remember having to place our cities in a certain pattern, the rings, the Civ 3? And
the definition of ICS?
Yeah.
Actually, imagine you're wrong. There's 15 votes now in the poll.
Wait, let me log into CFC. We can have 16.
Yes. It's on a secret ballot. It's disclosed to the interwebs what you voted. I don't know if people noticed that or not, but it's one of those open polls.
It's an open poll.
Now, that's a segue. I suggest that it's hard for people to see between these options without imposing the way the rest of the system worked, too. So the systems are very similar. They're kind of different ways of getting – they are exactly different ways of getting at the same thing. But when you judge, do you like corruption or city maintenance or global happiness, you're really judging, do I like the economic systems of this game as compared to this game as compared to this game?
I like global happiness. It's to me, it's transparent, which is the thing with the corruption and the city maintenance.
And, well, it also has local happiness now, so they're kind of forgot part of it.
Yeah, I was about to say.
They kind of forgot part of the mechanic.
The local happiness of the Civilization V expansion, Gods and King, introduced.
To me, at least, it's more transparent than trying to figure out city maintenance or corruption. It's right there in front of you. You have this local happiness, you have this happiness.
In a previous iteration of Civ, prior to 5, they really, really, really needed to tell you the rules, and they didn't. It was very asinine that it took a lot of work to determine how much extra maintenance you would pay on an additional city, or, you know, to what extent corruption would be hitting you before you planted the city. You know, that's not real difficulty at all. That's garbage that you have to find out, that you have to bend over backwards to figure that.
Yes, in 5, you still have to watch how you're building your cities, but it's more obvious when you're getting close to that limit and you need to stop and build upwards instead of out.
Yeah.
How are you not finding more happiness if you're conquering things?
If you're on Prince, really.
There's something to be said, though. Like, if you really want one of those continent-stretching empires with, like, 20, 30 cities, that's not exactly easy for a typical person to manage in Civ 5. Whereas in the previous games, you could pull that off pretty well.
If you can't manage it, you shouldn't do it.
Civ 1 to a lot of people before Civ 5. So if you try to do that in Civ 5, the mechanic's going to punish you like crazy.
Yeah, but if you tried to ICS in Civ 4, the mechanics would beat the crap out of you, too.
Yeah, city maintenance for that number of cities if you win ICS was just insane.
Yeah, so that's not a valid complaint.
Still like 10 to 12 cities in the BC sometimes in Civ 4 and still be running at a positive, sometimes even researching well if the land is really good. It's really only Civ 5 that you, like Majin said, want to hold yourself to, like, the 4 or 5 cities. The previous games, that wasn't true at all.
You can still go to the 10, 12 cities easily. It's just you need to know what you're doing.
Is it optimized?
Is it optimal? Maybe.
The land for that, that was optimized. Whereas in Civ 5, you seem to be implying otherwise most of the time.
If you know what you're doing, you can ICS very easily. Have 10, 12 cities by the Renaissance, more, 20, depending on the map size, and still be happy. There are ways to do it.
You know, that's not to say that Civ 5 is bad, but it's very different from a city spam side of things.
Yeah, Civ 4.
I think there was a pretty focused attempt in Civ 5 to allow those smaller empires to play and maybe even encourage smaller empires just on average. So instead of talking about, you know, remember the Civ 3 days, you know, the huge empires, you know, of never running at that size and getting them bound to, you know, you have less cities, but, you know, they're bigger cogs of your machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I decided I would go ahead and vote in this poll now since, you know, why would I do it before we started recording the show? Kale did the same thing, so we're actually up to 17 votes now. Mackie, you're not on board here.
I can't remember my COC login.
Macalua?
Well, that, no, my password. Let me be more specific there. I had to change it to
529.
No.
The poll now at 17. Let's update the numbers. Man, this is just like election night.
Yeah, except that we're constantly voting.
Corruption and city maintenance are neck and neck, with city maintenance at 7, corruption at 6, and global happiness at 4. And Imagine and I have voted for global happiness.
Hey, don't tell anybody that.
I can see it.
It's like half the votes.
hey, it's about quality votes, not quantity.
Yeah, it's true.
Now, the main team has voted for city maintenance, and Kale has voted for corruption. Yeah, he did. So seeing as how we saw corruption in Civilization 1, Civilization 2, and Civilization 3, not that they were all the same, but they were variations on kind of the same approach towards, in part, this infinite city sprawl equals awesome for you. Now, I realize this is not an absolute, but this is kind of the more often than not. So trying to combat that. So, Kale, not to put you on the spot, but I'm going to do it anyway. Why did you vote for corruption?
And no problem being on the spot. I think about these things all the time. I like corruption because I feel like it does the best job of balancing big empires versus little. So if I can go out and affect, yes, you can have 10 cities, and here is the performance you're going to get out of your 10 cities as compared to your 4 cities, it gives me, as a game designer, it gives me a much better tool for managing that growth. And actually, I can scale things on a very even basis without having to individually tweak and balance on them. So it's a nice system for allowing the players to expand, that allow the players to have the empire they want to, and still being able to keep production in a bandwidth that I'm pacing for, rather than if I have 3 cities, then you have 3 times the production or 3 times the research or what have you there. I don't like city maintenance because I always feel like the point of cities is to build that economy up, and city maintenance seems the exact opposite of that, which drives it down. You also have those death spiral issues where I like corruption because things make it to be less efficient, but you don't death spiral on it. And global happiness is kind of a harder limit for that growth, and it kind of constrains players in more specific ways, in my opinion.
Follow-up question to what you've said there, Derek. Given that we've seen corruption in Civilization 1, 2, and 3, is there an implementation of corruption that we've seen in the Civ series so far that you prefer more than others, and perhaps that's the reason why you voted for corruption, or is it more or less equal across all 3 or maybe 2?
I have a corruption mechanic in Fallen Enchantress. It's called Unrest there, but it's very similar to corruption where you have the more cities you have, the more unrest you deal with, and there are ways to kind of mitigate that unrest and bring it down. So that's why, just speaking from a mechanic perspective, why I prefer the corruption mechanics as compared to the other two.
Damn it. No, you don't. I've been playing Fallen in Trenches. There is no unrest per number of cities scaling, or at least it didn't make it to the game I play.
That is correct, and it's not in the version that you're playing.
Yeah. The faction prestige, the growth of cities is definitely, the more cities you have, the less growth you have from your prestige, because it divides it across all of that.
One common global growth counter for everybody that's applied to all your cities, so the more cities you build, the slower they all grow. Yep.
Yeah, unless you individually boost them.
Yep.
So I can see that. I don't quite mind the Forbidden Enchantress one, but then you have other limiters. And again, this is about the system around it, because in Fallen Enchantress, you have other limiters, such as you can't just spam cities anywhere you feel like.
Yes.
Choices about where you put them. So you can't have, like, a map full of cities. So, again, it's about systems. And that's
It's really hard to judge these as base mechanics by themselves. What is the game desire trying to encourage? What is the gameplay that they're trying to push out?
Yeah. That's why I prefer global happiness over corruption, because I didn't like the distance factor corruption. It forced you to want to super pack everything, and that doesn't turn into a good game. That just turns into a, well, okay, now we super pack and go from there, and there's no ability to just drop a city somewhere across the planet and, you know, make it a really big city. It's too far away, which isn't realistic at all. City maintenance, I kind of agree with you on that one. Cities should be growing. I mean, I do like a city maintenance requirement, like, and even in Civ 5, there's maintenance cost for buildings and stuff like that.
I like your example there, putting a city somewhere else. You say it's not realistic, which doesn't mean a whole lot to me, but I do. It shouldn't be a goal of game design to make it realistic, but I do like that it's limiting a player's option. You know, hey, if I want to have that city that's over there, you know, maybe there's an effect for it, but it should still be very viable, and depending on how that mechanics tweaks, sometimes it's just not, and I just don't feel like I have those tools available to me as a player anymore.
Yeah, and that's what the problem with corruption. But global happiness, you can actually make organic empires. There eventually is a hard cap on the number of cities you can drop, but that's fine. There is a balance between tall and wide in Civ 5. And again, with the system around it, the taller your cities are, there's a lot of buildings and other modifiers that are percentile increases. Tall
now,
cities can get...
You're saying that it's unrealistic, that it's much more difficult to maintain a very distant city. But I'm not sure that's necessarily true, especially throughout most of history, where planning a city halfway across the world really wasn't, like, your empire really couldn't defend it and really couldn't communicate it with it effectively. I don't know that I agree with that. I think that that element of having
an
empire is a worthy one in Civ, if you want to go from a realism standpoint. Gameplay perspective, I go half and half on a gameplay perspective. Like, if you ignore realism entirely, is on the one hand, it's already very difficult to defend a very distant city. But, the AI in every game has not been the bad at punishing people for doing that. So, I don't know.
Yeah, no, there is other limiters. Like, yeah, if you drop a city halfway around the world and there's AIs around there, you might lose that city. And that's the movement mechanic of units and all that stuff. Or at least in Civ 5 and all the mechanics, you can choose to go a couple cities and go tall and be competitive with somebody who just goes ICS spam. Where that's not really the case in Civ 4 or Civ 3. Just if you look at the mechanics on how the limitations be trying to be applied.
In an update on the poll, who's listening to the show right now is Ian, and he's logged in as a Ustream user. He has voted for global happiness, and Mackie figured out her password or reset it. She has also voted global happiness.
Thank you, Mackie.
So corruption and global happiness are now trailing city maintenance by one. That's 7 and tied to 6.
And I'm creating new Civ Fanatics accounts right now so I can vote.
Yeah.
No stuffing the ballot box.
Okay, when I was voting on this, I rolled out corruption. And the reason I did that is you basically get the tremendous diminishing returns on cities, but only very late. So you had this core empire, which was pretty much the same for everybody. The incentive was always to spam cities like crazy. So there really wasn't a lot of variety based on terrain or based on game situation or even play style preferences, really. If you wanted to do really well, you spam cities. That's pretty much how it rolled. And I didn't like that. Now, that's not true for either global happiness or city maintenance. So when I'm picking between those two, they're actually not as different as they might seem at first glance. They're not. You can get into that downward death spiral in both games. It's a little bit less drastic in Civ 5, but, you know, if you put yourself into, like, 20, 30, 40, 50 unhappiness, you're probably not going to be in good shape. That'll probably ruin you pretty good if you're playing against anybody competent or on a difficulty level that's challenging.
Yeah, but it's a self-limiting mechanic.
But it's the same thing with maintenance.
You can lose those cities, and then you'll get your happiness back.
Well, I guess, but how many turns have you wasted? I mean, you know, let's be fair. If you're playing on like total difficulty compared to your ability, you can probably recover, sure. But if you're not,
yeah, it's
not going to be so easy. And, yeah, I mean, it would basically kill you in Civ 4, but you had to go overboard, too. You know, like I said, if you knew what you were doing, you could get a lot of cities very quickly in Civ 4. And the reason I liked that mechanic, it was a very, very drastic thing, and you had to plan, okay, you know, how quickly is the city going to become a net contributor to my empire instead of a drain on it? In your first couple of cities, it was immediately. So you'd want to settle your second and third city pretty quickly. But then you had the plan around terrain, too. And I think any of the other civs have captured the impact of the tiles themselves quite to the extent that Civ 4 has. And maybe that's part of the reason I went for maintenance over happiness. Maybe if you flipped it, I would have picked happiness, too. I don't know. The way maintenance surrounded the economic system in Civ 4 caused a very, very huge variety of how you could approach your economic game as well as how you could approach ICS. I mean, there were some games where you could get away with spamming cities without building a single cottage. And, you know, there are some games where you just carpet the map in cottages or, you know, you're relying on a wonder, for example.
I will say to your point, I did think a lot more about my economy in Civ 4 than I did in the other versions. I was constantly kind of keeping that gold total in mind and whether it was coming in and going out.
To that end, Zyman in the chat said, it's just easier to understand and manage for me. Because, again, he also voted for happiness.
Different mechanics for different systems of the game. Some are better than others. I guess the question is, does it work within the rest of the system? So ignore whether or not you like happiness, ignore whether or not you like maintenance or corruption. Does it work? Did it do its job within its system?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think Civ 5's global happiness does a good job of balancing out small cities, incredibly small compared to former versions of Civ versus a larger empire. So it accomplished its goal there. I think that the Civ 4, I was, you know, like Mad Jen brought up earlier, we were thinking a lot more about the economic game in that game and keeping in mind on our gold values. So city maintenance accomplished its goal there. And corruption in Civ 3, I don't know. I built cities all over the place in Civ 3. That's just what that game was.
So yeah. I think the answer is corruption failed to complete its goal. Therefore, it's not the best trick.
For those people who are listening and you're deciding for yourself, even if you haven't played all Civilization titles, and if you haven't, shame on you.
Yeah, seriously.
Nomadic Era Alternate Start Idea, and this comes from Galgus. This would be an optional change to the game geared towards player like time to explore before settling their first city. The Nomadic Era would take place while agriculture is being researched. Researching agriculture unlocks the Nomad's ability to found a capital, the option to declare war, and the default ability to produce farms. Instead of a settler, players in Nomadic Era start with a nomad, which has the gold, culture, and science output of a newly founded capital. Social policy still cannot be adopted until the civilization's capital is founded, but culture gains from the nomad stores up for when it is. The nomad's science research automatically works toward unlock agriculture, but can also store up for progress in the next technology research. The game wouldn't necessarily have to start players in a bad spot for a city in the Nomadic Era. My intent is more that players would have several options of valid starting areas than a hunt for a single good spot, quote unquote. He also talks about how the Nomad is a combat unit with strength 5 and the medic promotion, although it could not stack. He talks about how city-states and natural wonders would probably function as they do right now in Civilization 5. The Nomad produces the output of a starting capital to give players more of an option to wait a brief time to found their city after the Nomadic Era ends. They may want extra time to move into a newly discovered sweet spot. However, they still miss out on some of the population growth, production, cultural border expansion, and the security of founding the capital. And overall, the comments, as limited as they are in this thread, have been positive. A great idea, says Kurt Bob. A little exploration for setting up a capital would be very fun. And Halp says, I hate the start of the game where you only see your immediate vision area. Nomad for a few turns may be a nice addition.
I gotta laugh.
Well, then do that.
I have to, because if you remember a certain April 1st post on CFC News about the upcoming expansion, if you go back all the way to April 1st of this year, there just happened to be this little thing called the pre-ancient era, or whatever we ended up calling it. Basically this. Oh, so what did we call it in the... I finally found it. So 2K for Hexes heard about the community's concerns and took action in Gods and Kings. Players now start in the prehistoric era and have to learn agriculture before becoming a civilization. All new animal units are out in the wild with barbarians to give you something else to play with in the early game. Animal units can be domesticated and some even replace horses in the later eras. The classical era was merged into the ancient era to allow for this change. Explore all the new tech, all new techs such as fire. Grog makes a club, or made a club, and don't eat that. Along with new beliefs in the Pantheon section of
the religion mechanics. Awesome.
Thanks. They approve.
Let's make it happen.
I think this nomad idea could be fun. I always liked Advanced Start in Civ 4 because it allowed you to kind of scout that area and place things down. I know a lot of it was, you know, really skipping that early game, but just because I can see more of the map and kind of place, all right, well, city here. And this kind of does this in a more game-centered way.
Oh, you like Advanced Starts. That's why it's been 4 years since you've been on this show. You know, I look at what Galgus has had to say, and I also like the idea, and I think that's an important qualification that was already said, that it could be fun. I mean, pretty well anything we talk about in the research lab could be fun, although sometimes, just as a concept, we're like, no. When he says right at the outset that this would be an optional change to the game, I'm like, okay, so I'm taking that to mean that in the game setup, you could decide whether or not you're going to have the nomadic era or not. Let's actually either have it or don't have it, first and foremost. But this part about you still miss out on some population growth, production, culture, border expansions, and the security of founding a capital if you don't do that way to Ray, he talks about social policies cannot be adopted until a civilization's capital is founded, but culture gains from the nomad and it stores up. Oh, and although you're automatically going towards agriculture, you can store up progress for the next technology to be researched as well. So, to me, the game is about choices, and I'm not saying that there isn't choice still, but I think part of that choice should be that if you're deciding that you want to move around to somewhere that's in a sweet spot, if you explore and you quote-unquote see that, something that would be helpful is that you see more of your immediate starting vicinity, a little more than you do right now.
Yeah. Because we've all had that time. I mean, you couldn't have placed this over one hex, you stupid game.
Yeah, or every single time I'm on a continent's map, hey, look, I'm 2 tiles from the coast, and there's a forest in the way. Yay, I just wasted 2 to 3 turns.
So you'd say, okay, if you're able to move to that spot, then you are going to get agriculture, but any turn after however long it takes agriculture, and they talk about, you know, scaling to game speed, and yes, that's very important, whatever that number happens to be, any kind of culture accumulation, science accumulation after agriculture, you're going to then get that once you've found that city. But in seeing a larger area, if you decide by moving those 5 turns, I'm going to be better off, say, at turn 10, I spent 5 turns doing nothing, but what I'm going to get after 5 turns means in turns 5 to 10, I've got more than I would have had from turn 0 to 10 by settling in place, then that was worth the move, whereas the choice is also, there is the potential that something could happen to my nomad. I mean, he also talks about it being a combat unit with strength 5, and there's also discussion about having an accompanying warrior. Have it so that the nomad has some kind of defense, but there's still the possibility that if you let your warrior, say, wander too far away from it, trying to say, oh, I want to scout out some other areas as well, then there should be the risk that even though that's the sweet spot, that sweet spot would have been realized if you had been protecting that unit properly. So I'm fine with the choices, but there are some things here that I think just make it a little too convenient to decide to go off and explore as opposed to settling in place.
Yeah, it should be a trade-off. And I like the prehistoric idea. You get a nomad, you can wander around, you can do stuff. But I think it's more in the, it has to be pre-turn zero. So if there's a nomadic era, it's before turn zero. And you're not gaining extra culture, you're not gaining extra science, you're not gaining extra stuff than you would if you didn't do the nomad era. But it would, I mean, you know, you can balance it out going, say you do have this pre-turn zero space, maybe you do settle in place, then for the whatever time period between nomad start and ancient era start, maybe you do get the growth and everything else because you stopped and settled right away. But then, you know, you move around, you get the bonuses, but maybe, you know, you find some animals on the map, you domesticate them, maybe you get a boost towards animal husbandry if you took the time to go wander around. Or, you know, there's different ways that you can make that initial start do various things. Like maybe if you fought a little bit, you get access to some of the honor policies or something else along that line. Basically, you can use that pre-start time to customize the civ you're playing rather than it always being the same. Or basically just adjust it just enough, not too much to that, you know, doing this would be worth more than a normal start, but just enough to make the game slightly different each time. That'd be okay with, but not, you know, get a period of time where you're going to be better off than if you didn't do it.
It does steal a little bit from the, I think in the game pace right now, you drop your capital, you start exploring a little bit, and you start looking for the, where am I going to put my second city? And it's kind of interesting, this idea kind of flips that. Right now it's about city, what I want to produce, what I want to tech on, and then explore and find that second place where it kind of tries to reverse that. And, well, let's explore first. Let's find out where I want to place my city, and then start into the big empire things. I think it would steal a little bit from the kind of the excitement and kind of the neat things. One of the neat things in Civ is I get my capital down, I start my things, I get my explorer out there, and now I say, okay, now let's head out into that scary fog of war and see what's out there. I still like the nomad idea. I think it's definitely worth trying and playing with, but I can see the advantage of the other side too.
You have the choice that you want that, you know, let's settle in place, and then, okay, let's go and explore, and the trade-offs to that, as opposed to actually wandering around and deciding to settle in place, that it's, I wouldn't so much say that it's stealing, is that it's time-shifting. In other words, do you want to settle and then explore, or do you want to explore and then settle? And you know what, in fact, it makes me think of some of the discussions on RevCast with regards to Civilization Revolution, and the interesting discussions that they can have right now about whether or not you settle in place, whereas opposed to right now in Civ, there can be time where maybe a turn or two is better, that you are going to be better off than that, but the potential payoff, there's the big risk that something is going to happen to you, you know, i.e. The game is over. Exactly. So I like that this adds this kind of element to, as opposed to crapshoot, whereas this gives us more kind of a strategic consideration, and certainly there are the nuts and bolts that would need to be refined, and, you know, inevitably, as good of a concept is, until it's playtested, it's still only, you know, theoretical, but the fact that you would have that option there, I think it's worth incorporating.
I think yeah. It would need the greater visibility that you mentioned, though, because asking players to, I could settle right now and start getting better production or get my city growing, or I could wander and maybe I would get the opportunity to get that animal domestication bonus, but I don't know, so I go out into the darkness and I'm either like, oh, this is cool, this happened, or, well, nothing happened, I should just restart my game now, is always a bad situation to have the player in, especially a strategy game for the first couple turns is completely up in the air. But give them the more visibility, and I think it becomes a much more strategic decision.
Yep.
And that greater visibility should be a circumference, by the way, not off in one direction. Oh, look at the more area I can see. Oh, more ocean. Great.
Yeah. Hey, look, I got a map of water. Yeah, I love that map of water. I mean, even in Deity, I've moved upwards of 5-6 turns worth in the first bit. I mean, sometimes there's a reason to move. Like, your starting location sucks. So you move. And then you find an awesome place. It's also amusing because the starting locations are technically balanced-ish for luxuries and all that-ish. But if you move a couple turns to a different direction, you might have your starting location luxuries, or strategics, depending on where they happen to be, and other stuff. You already do have that little bit of wander before settling. It just, you have to give up the initial growth, initial culture, and initial production, and the security of owning a capital. Basically, what the guy's last line was. But you can do it right now.
this name is too low. I know we talked about this person before. He talks about how your ideas, and your ideas being Galgus and mine, have some overlap, and it is something that a thread that he started in September, whereas this nomadic thread era thread was back in August. He talks about Cradle of Civilization, and he gets into some of the specifics of his suggestions. You know, several things that the player can tweak in the game setup, like the total number of AI nomads, the number of AI nomads which can found civilizations, the number of starting barbarian camps, nomads found city-states, not civilizations. You'll need to grow your city-state to evolve it into a civilization. You'll have no way of knowing which AI city-states will evolve into competing civilizations beforehand. And I'm thinking, if this is in the context of Civilization V, where we already have city-states and it serves a purpose already beyond what we would have in a nomadic era, I'm just kind of like, no.
Well, it takes down the question of, okay, should I settle here because all these guys around me are going to be city-states, or should I not settle here because all the six city-states surrounding me, all within 5 or 6 tiles of me, will all turn into civilizations? Yeah. Not to mention that doesn't really scale very well per difficulty level, especially with DD getting 2 settlers. They would have double the nomads, or get a power nomad. Okay, Greedred made a title called Paradox Inspired Diplomacy and Warfare. So what he'd basically like to see, without reading this wall of text, his basic concept is that Paradox games, like Crusader's King, Europa, blah, 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 use different styles of diplomacy and reasons for war. So what he was basically looking at is how could Civ 5 incorporate some of these Paradox-based methodologies towards diplomacy and war. The only thing is, Crusader's Kings,
Europa Universalis.
There you go, EU3. And the other ones are big strategy games, as in grand strategy, where you don't have much to do other than diplomacy.
I mean, you might go to war occasionally, but...
But then you just, like, put little figurines and little numbers, and there's no interaction.
And you see them stabbing or shooting at each other. Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that the grand strategy game has slightly more in-depth diplomacy than Civ 5, because if it didn't, well, then it wouldn't be a good game for a grand strategy game. But some of the ideas do have merit, and I'm sure some of the stuff has come up before. Is top one, obviously, the Cassius Belli. So to start a just war, you need to cause a war. So you can conclude, depending on whatever it is, claim on titles, claim on territory. So you need a reason to go to war, and you have to be able to state that reason. So of course you have to get the AIs being able to state why they're backstabbing you. And then declaring war without a valid cause will drive up your bad boy status. Basically, other AIs and players will dislike you for starting wars for no reason. And you'll get diplo penalties, reputation hits, blah, blah, blah. Which is fine. I'm pretty sure we can add that into Civ 5 pretty easily. Number one cause of AIs declaring war on you, because they can. Backstab. No, there's usually a reason, and they have lots of reasons. So it may not be just as obvious. His point is that it's a just war versus a just random war. And the diplo penalties therein, and that is something that's not there. There is no, myself and this other AI are going to declare war on you together because you wiped out that fourth guy. There's no just cause for others to limit you on that. And then, of course, the war score. So during each war, each side gets score based on battles, blah, blah, blah. During the peace negotiations, war score determines who has the advantage. This is no different than Civ. The only problem with Civ is that the mechanic for who's winning is completely and utterly stupid and never worked the way it's supposed to.
Whereas the way it's set up, like in Europa Universalis, you can see how you've accumulated whatever percent and what it's going to cost you of that percent to ask for certain things.
Keep in mind that when Majin said that it's never worked in Civ, he means it. He doesn't mean just Civ 5. The war success mechanic, or whatever it's called across various games, has never worked properly in a Civ series. So this is interesting, actually.
So, I mean, yeah, definitely getting it better would be nice. Because the AI always thinks it's winning, even as you slowly kill it and, you know, you're nuking its territory piece by piece. I'm like, no, I'm still winning. And then, of course, in peace negotiation. Now, this is the difference between the Civ series and the Grand Strategy series. Mainly, you can negotiate white pieces, which you can do in Civ 5, or Civ, well, any of the Civs as well. But basically, you just say, okay, we're done fighting. But in the Civ series, if you took over half an empire and you negotiated a white peace, you'd still keep that half of an empire. Whereas in the Grand Strategy style of games, if you went for a white peace, you'd give back that half of empire because it'd be the state before the war, which is, you know, not a Civ-based concept. In Civ, if you took it, you keep it, unless you give it back.
Yes, so Canadians, Americans, think of the War of 1812.
We gave you back some territory after we made peace.
It's kind of more, we didn't want that anyway.
You could do that, or you could demand concessions, which would obviously be based on your war score, such as territory or titles or whatever it is. So basically, the object of the peace negotiation inclusion would be that even if you do go run over somebody, if you then make peace and don't have a high enough war score, you have to give all of their stuff back when you go to make peace, which, of course, in a Civ game makes no sense. But I could see some benefit to that being in there, especially if the war score gets a little bit better. Like, hey, I've trashed your entire army. If we're going to make peace, you're going to give me something, or else I'll just take your cities. Because cities really are the core of a Civ game, whereas in Grand Strategy, you can have various provinces. They're much weaker overall in comparison to cities within each other games. And then he gets into war score and everything else, but frankly, there's better ways to do it. Rolling averages and all that other stuff. And then, of course, peace negotiations. It's no different than what we already have, especially after the latest patch with 9 levels of peace negotiations. But he does throw stuff in there that we don't have, like convert to my religion, disallow building military units, must adopt policies. Except the problem with the adopt policy and force switching from one tree to another, the culture system doesn't allow for take-backsies. So if you spent your culture on a policy, you can't re-spend that culture. It's gone. So that might be a little harder to deal with. And if you can force adopt into a policy tree that you didn't have already and you don't have the culture to spend into, then I can see a few people blatantly abusing that. Sure, I'll lose the war and let you give me 5 culture policies for free. Then total annex, which doesn't really matter in Civ, because if you've wiped out the Civ, they're wiped out. So,
I think you make a good point. It makes a lot of sense in a game that's not a war game. So it depends on how much you are planning on having, how much of the military game is the game. In Civilization series, to me, is very much a war game. The military game's a big piece. It means a lot that I can see my opponent's borders right next to me, and I'm always thinking about they could declare war on me in a second and rush in, and I'm always prepared for that. And there's that gives a lot of tension to the game in a Civilization game. I wouldn't want to, well, they can't declare war on me because, you know, I haven't done anything wrong. As long as I don't do these things, I'm safe, because it puts me in a less interesting place in a Civ game. If the game is all based around the non-war pieces and war was kind of a smaller section, then I think this is perfect, just like you said, but I don't think it's quite right for Civ, at least the cause of war part.
Well, I mean, no, that's the thing. The cause could be fine, but I think that's, again, just maybe twist it slightly more towards, again, more informative for players, which a lot of people want, obviously. Why are they declaring war on you? Should the other AIs pay attention to that based on their flavors?
Yeah, why do we declare war on the AI? Because they have some iron that we really want.
Yeah.
Because if you do it the other way, you have to come up with a legitimate diplomacy-sounding reason.
Yeah, I don't know that. I mean, even in his sample there, he says, you know, it should be possible to declare war. You just get everybody kind of hates you for it if you do that. I could see something like this based on, you know, a social policy or government choice where you get a lot of advantages under this policy, but you need a cause of war in order to be able to declare wars. You don't have the freedom to be able to go attack, attack, attack. But, heck, when I'm playing my military game and picture myself as that cruel empire and I'm all manifest destiny, I don't need cause. I'm going to take them because I want to take them.
And that should be a good cause for some of those AIs that have the same flavor.
Yeah.
So the big pro-military, you know, autocrats, they should be all like, you're making your empire bigger, and it's not through me. Go for it.
Yeah. I am Genghis Khan, and that is enough.
Yeah. I'm getting your son. What do you expect? Seriously.
You expect me not to expand in your face? Yeah, we're used to in Civ just being able to declare war because, you know, no good reason, no bad reason, no reason.
But then playing when the AI does it.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, the only thing about this makes me think, in terms of some of these changes, how it would impact, say, in multiplayer, human versus human. Because some of it translates well and other doesn't. I mean, it depends.
Your mom? It's got to be on the list.
Just in the sense that it wouldn't be so much about their opinion, whereas opposed to, of course, some of the other things is know that there would be an actual in-game effect. So I think so long as that it could still be felt or it wouldn't be, you know, counter to what you would have in a human versus human multiplayer situation. I mean, I've got no issues otherwise, really, with most of what's been said already, but there's just that kind of added consideration there.
Yeah, you can see that.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Dan, your memory is way too good with
we've noticed.
Things like that.
That's just Dan's memory period is a little too good sometimes.
He has a memory period?
What? Why did you even say that?
You said it.
Yeah, you did say it.
I didn't mean that kind.
Thank you very much for having me on. Today we talked about the follow-up patch that's coming out for Gods and Kings. Rate the beliefs. Let the community get feedback on them. Corruption versus maintenance versus happiness. And why corruption was the best of those options.
Wait a minute. That's not what we agreed on.
Wait a minute. You know what? People are talking about my memory. I was about to credit Derek's great memory for remembering how we used to do summary topics. And then I realized the whole reason to start doing the summary was to be able to say that.
Yeah.
You got it exactly. Well, I'm going to continue even if you don't keep doing it anymore. We talked about the nomadic era start idea, the paradox inspired diplomacy, and congratulations to Gods and Kings for getting the best strategy award, the best gold joystick.
Haha, see that? We've now got a quote. The lead designer for Fallen Enchantress has acknowledged that Gods and Kings is winning.
Gods and Kings is a great game. I'm going to say anything different. John's office is about 3 away from mine, so I'm never going to say anything bad about Civ 5.
Gods and Kings had nothing to do with him.
I know, but as I said, nothing bad about Civ 5 in general. Good. I know it didn't have anything to do with him. He was 3 offices away from me when it was being made. Oh, what else do you normally do on the ending?
Well, other than make fun of John for how bad Vanilla was.
Derek has no comment on that.
You want me to say goodbye to everybody? The new guy? The guest? Alright, what episode number is it, Dan?
What are you, Imran? No. It's 161.
161. This is, of course, as everybody knows, episode 161. Phil, thank you for being on.
Absolutely. I have the perfect global happiness plan for all of you.
Imagine, thank you.
Awkward moment achieved.
Makalua?
Achievement get once every 4 years.
Golden joystick? Oh, no, something else.
And Dan, thank you very much for having me.
You are welcome, and just one more topic!
No.
Just one more. Just one more.
All right, well, I'll talk to you guys again in 4 years.
What were you saying, Mackie?
Now I'm off track. You interrupted me, I forgot.
Phil.
No. I blame the Jen.
Dan.
Let's just blame Derek.
Okay. We'll blame the guests. That's so nice. What?
It's not like we're picking on Derek specifically. We're just picking on the guest specifically, who happens to be Derek this time.
Because that makes it so much different.
Now I won't remember why it's been 4 years since I've been on here.
You got blamed last time.
It's like suddenly.
Recorded November 17th, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.